This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and, yes, women sometimes who have some pretty impressive stories to tell about the things they've done for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, we learn things that we had never even imagined, and I know that's going to be the case today. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to meet a young man today who's not quite 89 years old in Fresno, California, Charlie Wadhams, originally from Brockport, New York. You talk about two different climate extremes. Here we are in the summer in Central California. That's a pretty different weather than you had growing up in upstate New York, huh?
You better believe it. Yeah, and I don't miss it a bit.
What can you tell us about your childhood there? What was life like there in the 30s and 40s?
Well, I lived in a small farming community. I would say 8 or 10,000 people. I mean, a small high school. We had a state teacher's college there. I actually went to college for 8 years before I went to high school.
How'd you pull that off? You know, I've had hundreds of veterans, and no one's ever said they went to college for 8 years. Did you say before you graduated high school?
Before I went to high school.
There's got to be a story there. What's the story?
The story is that the teaching college had a demonstration school. So each of our classroom teachers, my first grade teacher was an assistant professor of education. Each of my classroom teachers up through the eighth grade was, they were all professors. We could unhinge a student teacher in about 4 minutes.
What other things did you spend your childhood doing? And were you aware? Was the depression something that was palpable for you?
It was very present all over town, all over our lives. People had tough times, but there the churches took care of everybody. I mean, you know, we didn't have the social programs like they have today. We at one time had a few guys and families that were very bad news. One guy got convicted of murder, sent to Sing Sing, you know. I mean, all of that was there, but it was people taking care of each other. And so, yes, we were very aware of it.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters, and they still survive. My oldest sister, Pat, is 92, and my next is Janie, who's 90.
So you were the baby. You had those two sisters looking out for you.
And giving me orders, even today.
Even today. I love it.
When I enlisted, they give you all these tests and whatnot. They said, yes, you do okay at mechanics and things, so we're going to send you to New Orleans to be a machinist mate. I came home from boot camp. The day that I left, I said goodbye to my dad. He dropped me off the railroad station, and he said, so long, I'll see you next weekend. I said, yeah, probably I'll get leave and so forth. I went back to Sampson, and 2 days later, they put me on a train, and I didn't go to mechanical school. I went to San Diego to the amphibious training base.
And how long was it till you saw your father again?
2 years.
Yeah, so much for next weekend.
Yeah.
When did you decide to join the Navy and why?
It was automatic that I go in the service. Nobody had any great debate about the social values of being in the military. Everybody just did it. My father had been in the Army with the New York 27th Division, had fought with the Belgians in World War I. He was in a machine gun battalion, and at that time it was a brand new weapon.
Yeah.
And they sent him to school, so he was a sergeant instructor in machine gunnery, and then they sent him to OCS. Fun part of it, that one was he graduated from OCS on November 11th, 1918, and they never gave him his second lieutenant.
because the armistice was signed?
Because it was over now. We don't need any more lieutenants. And he was in this group called the New York Guard. When the National Guard moves out, the New York Guard moved in. And he would take me out with them, and some of his sergeants taught me how to shoot.
So as a boy, you're exposed, because your father's in the Guard, you're exposed to all this military stuff.
I knew the manual of arms before I went to boot camp.
Well, why didn't you join the Army then?
Last thing my father said was, Charlie, I spent a year and a half over there, and he said, I lived in the mud all the time. That's what dugouts and trenches were all about. And he says, go in the Navy and get on a ship. You got a warm, dry bunk there every night. And he said, if it's not there, it's all over anyhow. Incidentally, that brings out the point that every kid who's 17 or 18 years old thinks himself immortal anyhow, so that just went over your head.
How old were you when you signed up?
Well, I was 17.
Mm-hmm. And you told us the story of saying goodbye to your father at the train station, expecting to see him shortly, but not seeing him for 2 years, and they shipped you all the way out here to San Diego for training. What are the things you remember about those training days, and what did amphibious training consist of way back then?
San Diego's amphibious training base, and the training then, a fair amount of it was precursor to what the SEALs are getting today. There were two basic groups there. One group was called UDT, the Underwater Demolition Teams, and the other were the boat crews.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trained in a lot of combat. We had to learn how to shoot all of our own equipment and a number of foreign weapons. Because if you got on the beach and your boat got busted up, what you've got to do is pick up what you've got in your boat. Or we had two 30 caliber machine guns on the back end of the boat, but you can't carry them off. So we would be trained to pick up any kind of a weapon we could get our hands on and go help.
And the boat you're talking about, these are Higgins boats, LCVPs?
Yeah, Higgins made them and Chris Craft made them too. They were built tough as can be. They weighed 9 tons, and you had a 400 diesel engine in there. When the waves got higher than 8 or 9 feet, you sometimes had a riptide, and you had to learn how to handle a boat, because if you didn't do it exactly right, the boat would broach. And even in training, we lost one guy because the boat rolled over.
I mean,
9 tons of boat rolling around.
Most of the people listening, I'm imagining, have never been on an LCVP. I'm sure they've seen pictures and film of them at Normandy on June 6th. And
that's a famous picture. I know exactly what.
Yeah, so that people maybe are familiar with that, but most people haven't been on one, wouldn't be familiar with how they operated. So how many guys would make up a crew?
We started out with 4-man crews, and they would have the coxswain and an engineer and what they call a bow hook and a signalman. And the bow hook and the signalman, when you're making a landing, they'd have the two machine guns behind you. As coxswain, the controls were relatively simple. Anybody who's run a diesel, you know, punch the button and start it. And then it had a spade handle, which was the accelerator or forward and reverse. So the whole thing, it was just one thing. The boats, depending upon who built them, had a flat steering wheel. It actually had a screw thing on it where you could extend it up high and screw it down so that you could, under certain circumstances, you wanted to stand up higher so you could see better. When you're getting shot at, that's not a good idea. You know?
I would think not.
I never remember having that steering wheel up high.
And that was your job, was coxswain?
Yes. When we got to the ATB, we were put into a boat group, and some officers came and joined with us, and we were a boat group, and we stayed together for the rest of the war. So our crews were put together there. There were about 125 people in the boat crew. Our skipper was a lieutenant whose name was Comback. Ultimately, he wound up being a professor of physics at Monterey, I call it Canoe U West, the Navy postgraduate school at Monterey.
So when was that you went aboard that ship, the Brookings, and headed out to sea?
The 1st of January, 1945.
And there's still plenty to happen in the Pacific.
Yeah, we went right out.
Do you remember being excited about what was ahead? A little nervous, anxious, scared? What kind of emotions were going through that young man's mind?
I had a duty for several months, is a captain's messenger. The captain always has a kid following around with him, and he'd say, get me the gunnery officer, or get me so-and-so, or get me some-so. A seaman, usually the lowest guy in the bunch, got that duty for a while, and they every 2 or 3 months, they'd shift, get a new kid in there. The captain was from New York City, and he decided he liked me. He was not well-liked on that ship, so people called me awful names all the time. But one upside of all this is, when he'd go off the ship, he took me along to drive his Jeep for him. One day, I was driving him, and he went up to the San Francisco's Civic Center. The commandant of the Naval District was there. He got his orders for going overseas, and then they gave him an intelligence briefing. So he came down and got in the Jeep, and I'm driving back down to the waterfront, and he is really in a state. Well, this time we took off, and they'd loaded a lot of ammunition. We were going basically empty to Pearl. What they did was they loaded a lot of bombs and depth charges in our ship. A transport can't take many, but it was 2,500 tons of it. He was scared to death because there was one or two unidentified subs in our track. And nobody would go near us. I mean, we can't, when you're hauling ammunition, you go alone. Mm-hmm. And he was just absolutely scared to death.
Because you guys were essentially a floating bomb ready to go off.
You're on a floating bomb. And yeah. So I kind of got all upset about it myself.
Well, but is that something that he was trying to conceal from the crew or not make everyone else worry about it, but yeah. You were privy to because of your connection?
That's exactly right.
So that had to be a burden on you as an 18-year-old.
Yeah. Well, what happened is we went to sea and I got seasick for 4 days. And
so you had bigger concerns.
I was really seasick, and I didn't give a damn. I was hoping we'd get blown up, man.
That puts it in perspective.
I can look back on it. Incidentally, I got seasick that once, and for the rest of the time, I never got seasick again.
We were all wondering, weren't we? Time for our first break, but there's so much more to come. The things Charlie Wadhams witnessed in World War II, the mind-blowing top-secret developments he had to keep secret during the Korean War, and some emotional family moments 70 years ago and just in the past year. You'll be able to feel it, trust me. And speaking of family moments and veteran stories, you may have heard about the Vietnam War-themed film Faith of Our Fathers out in theaters. I haven't seen it yet, but I might soon because the film will be where I live in Fresno, California through August 20th. And the reason I'm bringing it up is veterans, military families, and veteran caregivers and their families can all see it for free. It's showing daily at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. through August 20th. And the free vouchers for Faith of Our Fathers are available at VA centers, at Break the Barriers, or by calling Rob Carter at this number, 559-269-5654. I don't normally make announcements like that, but since they're making it free for you veterans, I wanted to let you know. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.